From our newsroom in London, this is The Standard. This edition is a preview of the latest episode of Brave New World, a podcast where Evgeny Lebedev speaks to leading experts about the latest trends in modern medicine and how to maximise health and longevity. To hear the whole interview and listen to previous episodes, search Brave New World Evening Standard on your podcast provider.
On a previous episode, I spoke to Dr. David Sinclair, a renowned longevity scientist, about anti-aging and reversing our biological clock. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with the poster boy for longevity experiments, Brian Johnson. Brian started out as an entrepreneur, making hundreds of millions of dollars as a venture capitalist. But today, his mission is to live forever. Not because he's got a God complex, as you will find out, but because he believes it is essential for our survival and sustainability as a species, living in harmony with the world around us, and also because of AI. More on that later. Brian has spent millions of dollars to stymie his aging, and is most famous for a somewhat vampiric experiment in which he infused blood from his 17-year-old son, although he recently stopped saying it was ineffective. We're also joined by Brian's doctor, Oliver Zorman. By 2030, he aims to discover how to reverse the age of each of the 78 organs shared across both genders by 25%.
Ferdinand Magellan sought out to sail around the world. And in his time and place, that was one of the most ambitious things that one could contemplate. The ships had gotten to a point where they were sturdy enough to make that kind of voyage. They had learned enough about doing that. You could do that. And if you were to ask the question today, what would be the most ambitious endeavor one could imagine? It would be to try and slow the speed of aging and to reverse aging damage that has happened so that we could dramatically extend our lifespans. And that's what Dr. Zolman and I have been doing, is adventurers in the 21st century trying to do what most people consider to be impossible.
What got you first interested in this, and what was the change? What really was the kind of catalyst that made you decide to embark on this extraordinary journey?
It started when I was 21. I had been in Ecuador living among extreme poverty for 2 years, and I came back to the United States, and I just had this burning desire to try and be helpful to the world. I didn't know what to do, and so I decided I'd become an entrepreneur and make a whole bunch of money, and then with resources, try to chart a path. And so I built a company, Braintree Venmo, in payments. I sold that for $800 million about 10 years ago. And then I set my sights on that quest, which I had imagined at the age of 21, which is, what single thing could I do that would help humanity thrive beyond our imaginations? In particular, I wondered what could be done that the 25th century would find notable, in the same way we look back at the 16th and 15th century and respect those who did things in their time and place.
What was it that happened at 21 that made you think of this?
I was born into a deeply religious community. It was the only reality that I'd ever been exposed to. So it wasn't like I grew up where there were competing understandings of time and place. It was just one understanding: we're right, they're wrong. It's this group and the other group is the enemy. And when I came home, it kind of shattered my understanding of reality. Having lived in that world of extreme poverty was very different than my upbringing in the United States. And so it invited me to question everything I knew about reality. And at the age of 21, typically people are looking at a career of going to school, getting a degree, and then working throughout their lifetimes to retire. But that didn't make sense to me. The only thing that I really cared about was, trying to do something that would meaningfully change the course of humanity. Nothing else really made sense to me.
This was the notion at the time of meaningfully changing course of humanity, or you already had this idea that extending lifespan, health span is what you wanted to do?
No, I had no idea. And so my education is really primarily through biographies. School was pretty boring. It was so slow, and to memorize books and then regurgitate on tests never captured my attention. So I just read voraciously, and I've read hundreds of biographies. And when you look throughout history, when you analyze people who have done things that we still talk about today, most of the time they're accidental. It's a result of someone's curiosity or right place, right time, or something they discovered. It's much more difficult to try and pull out of thin air what will matter two or three or four centuries from now. And that was what I was trying to do. And I mean, it's an extraordinarily hard thought process because you're buried in time and place. We are all blinded to these realities. In every era, people live the ideas of dead people. You know, the time and place we live, we parrot all the ideas and concepts of people who are actually dead. The future is always here. It's just hard to recognize. And the question was really, could a methodical and maybe meandering process arrive at that? And so I never really had been in the world of anti-aging or regeneration. And it just seemed like it was the combination of the breakthroughs in medicine and computational intelligence that it had reached a threshold where one could set off on this endeavor and assess where we're at. I mean, we approach this with this open question of where is the science at right now? No one had ever done this before. No one had basically said, we're going to comb through all the literature and apply in one person every single therapy we can find. And so when I met Dr. Zolman, we were just meeting in the minds, and we've been attached to the hip ever since, pursuing this, what many people think as like a very wild endeavor.
How long has it been? How long have you been attached to the hip?
Almost 3 years now?
Is it 3.5?
Yeah.
It's gone fast.
This is Oliver Zolman, Brian Johnson's doctor.
Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about what Brian is doing at the moment, what you're doing with Brian, and just some of the, what day-to-day is like, and then some of the stranger things that you've been up to?
Yeah. So with Brian, I've always wanted to have a guinea pig. So I've been working on this for about 10 years since the beginning of medical school. It's about 7 years before I met Brian. And yeah, so I've always wanted to have someone where we could try every single therapy that came out in the literature. Because there's around 50,000 new randomized controlled trials that get published each year and a million new papers. So there's always crazy new therapies coming out with cool results.
This is human trials or animal trials as well?
Yeah, 50,000 randomized controlled trials per year, roughly. And then many other trials which aren't randomized but are still relevant. I've always wanted to have someone where I could try every single therapy in a safe, experimental manner. And Brian has become that person.
How do you determine what's safe, what's not safe?
Yeah, so I write a clinical guideline for experimental therapies according to international consensus criteria, called agreed-to criteria. And that involves extensive peer review by multiple world experts relative to each therapy.
What's an average day look like?
So it's not an average day. We're always doing weird new stuff, but in a safe way and in a highly documented way, where we're sharing results, doing extensive safety and efficacy monitoring. So it's not like kind of everyone else, which annoyed me before, where they're doing all these experimental therapies and not measuring even safety markers, never mind like efficacy markers, where we're measuring biological age of each of the organs inside of Brian's body using research grades, MRI, ultrasounds, other types of imaging devices and biofluids and biopsies and stuff. So it really varies.
Yeah, I mean, I think to make this easily understandable for your listeners, I'll just share a few of the biomarkers we have on me. So we slowed my speed of aging by the equivalent of 31 years. So I now accumulate aging damage slower than than 88% of the average 18-year-old. And
which biomarker is that?
That's looking at DNA methylation patterns.
And which one are you using? Do you have your own, or are you using one of the?
So TrueDiagnostic.com.
Yep. And then on my cardiovascular capacity, my body's ability to utilize oxygen, I'm in the top 1.5% of 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. My total bone mineral density is in the top 0.02% of 30-year-olds, which is the age men for the test. So no matter how you look, and we have 50 biological, 50 phenotypic markers like you'd find in blood that are perfect, you know, in the ideal range, and then 100 markers that are below my chronological age. And so when you look at the 20 or so markers that we've shared, it's pretty compelling that our 3 years of effort here have produced impressive results. that one can meaningfully do something about the aging process. We're not yet at the fountain of youth, but I think the evidence that we've shared does demonstrate it's worth the effort.
But you have to do it in the gold standard way. Mm-hmm. So if you do it in the gold standard way, yes, your calculation will be exactly right. But to do that, you have to perfectly calculate biological age of the individual's organs in every single organ and show that multiple times that it's an accurate and not changing randomly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can't use pace of aging for that. Mm-hmm. That's one new marker that's still being fully validated in the literature. But yeah, in theory, which is what I'm trying to do, which no one else has ever tried to do before, is accurately measuring every single organ in the body. It's biological age. And mm-hmm. if you can do that accurately, then yeah, you can say your age, 25% lower in every single organ on average, especially the clinically relevant ones, like heart, lungs, brain, kidneys, etc., arteries, then you can live 25% longer. Health span as well.
Health span.
It would all be health span.
25% may sound like a lot, but meeting Brian Johnson is to meet a man with no limits, who refuses to be limited. He is, to put it plainly, not a 25% guy.
It was a different route. After I sold Braintree Venmo, I made a few $100 million. I took $100 million of that and I invested it in synthetic biology, genomics, computational therapeutics, and nanotechnology, among other things. And my investing hypothesis was that in order for us to survive as a species, we need to be able to predictably engineer the physical elements of this world. So we're very good as a species at programming computers. If there's a problem that computer software can solve, we're very good at it. If there's a problem in the physical world, for example, if the coral reef is dying because the water is more acidic and it's warmer, it has higher temperature fluctuation, building a new coral type is more challenging. And so I invested in companies that were building with atoms and molecules and organisms. So for example, one company, to get rose oil, typically the process is you plant a rose seed, you grow the plant, you fertilize it, you water it, you harvest it. It's very expensive from a resources perspective, but you get rose oil as the output. The alternative is you take a yeast and you program the yeast to manufacture rose oil. And so you can use biology to do these processes that we've done in a very arcane way. And there's thousands of examples of how you can use biology to do these things. And so I saw through these investments that we had reached a point where we can reliably engineer biology and we can reliably engineer matter from atom to atom. And when I saw that happening with these companies doing things across the board for medicine, health, wellness, agriculture, infrastructure, consumables, and I paired that with medicine, it seemed to me the building blocks of how you could approach this systematically and scientifically was there. And if we could build a infrastructure where we scientifically approach this with measurement protocol in this rapid feedback loop, it might be a possibility that we start improving humans at the speed of technology.
What's the purpose? What's your ultimate goal?
Yeah, I mean, after 4.5 billion years on this planet, evolution as a system of intelligence produced us. We as a system of intelligence are producing artificial intelligence. So intelligence is producing intelligence, which is producing intelligence. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point in time, when intelligence gets to a certain level, the only foe becomes death. I mean, you look at evolution, the only objective function of evolution is continued existence.
Yeah.
The fact that we humans are suicidal and that we may be indifferent to life, that's an error with our cognition, because the fundamental system of intelligence driving existence only cares about continued existence. And as we give birth to artificial intelligence, that's probably going to be what it cares about too, is continue. So as a species, we're evolving to that next stage.
But it's continued existence and perpetuity of the species as opposed to continued existence of each individual. Well, what would you say is the ultimate goal of your project?
I think we're at a point right now where no human on this planet can state anything about the future. We can't say anything. We cannot say anything wise. We cannot say anything accurate. We cannot predict, model, anticipate. The future is totally blind to us because mm-hmm. we now have a form of intelligence that is superior to us. The only thing we can do is to continue to exist, is to not die. And that's what Oliver and I have been doing, is when you try to peel back the onion and you endeavor to answer existential questions and things about meaning making and existence and whether you should live or die, the only observation I can make is I don't want to die right now. And so therefore, the entire project is about that.
So is the purpose to not die as opposed to have a health span for as long as you can?
Sure. I mean, a health span is absolutely the, I mean, if you want to answer this question using the framework of the 21st century, of the early 21st century, you would say something polite like, we're going to increase health span and lifespan. And we're going to, you know, there's like a standard way you can use words to construct that kind of pleasantly sounded thing. When you put that in the shadow of baby intelligence, those things don't mean anything. We're up against a form of intelligence that is so dramatically better than what we are. None of our wisdom, ethics, morals, ideas, expectations matter anymore. We're walking into this future where we're no longer superimposing our will upon the world. And so it's a shift of where we're at as a species. So yes, I mean, in the immediate practical world, health span, lifespan, in every conceivable way. But really, I'm trying to get at this is a very special moment, different than every other moment in ways that break our minds.
So are you, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying that in a moment where artificial intelligence is potentially going to become more intelligent than us, what we need to do is to not die?
Yeah, I'm saying that when you look at where artificial intelligence has been applied in society, for example, AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol, the 19-time world champion at Go, and it trained on human Go data, became as good as a human, and then it trained against itself, and then became dramatically better than humans. And in a matter of days, it became better than all human genius over thousands of years playing that game. Mm-hmm. It just absolutely wiped the floor. No human has a chance. So when you get the systems pointed at these problems, whether it's narrow or increasingly broad, AI transforms our understanding of whatever thing is pointed at. The same is true when it figured out how the structure of all proteins, which people thought was an impossibly hard problem to solve. And so this is the thing when I construct words and say that this intelligence is so far superior to us, we can't even imagine it, I know people can't compute that, right? Like, we don't know what that means, but it really is the case. And so there's this sobriety for us to have right now that the only thing on humanity's to-do list is don't die individually, don't kill each other, don't kill the planet, and align AI with don't die. That's the only thing going on in the world right now.
Are you worried about AI?
I don't think anyone can express an opinion. It is uncertain in every direction.
Okay.
I don't think any human can express any opinion about it.
Okay. But just going back to my original question, with what does it do if we do achieve this of not dying, this quest of not dying, what does that put us in relation to AI?
Nobody knows.
Okay. But why do you think that's something that we must do in order to coexist with AI, let's say?
I'll say this one thing. I want to get Oliver's opinion on this. Blueprint is equally applicable to planet Earth as it is to my body. So with Blueprint, I've become the most measured person in human history. We use all that data. We look at the entire body of the scientific literature. And then we say, let's identify every possible way I'm dying. And then let's find the evidence to show how I can slow my speed of aging and reverse that. You can just replace my body with planet Earth. You do the same process. So we're currently in a difficult situation where our biosphere is in question. Will it be a home for us that's sustainable? You can measure planet Earth with millions of data points, look at the scientific evidence on what is a ideal biosphere, land, air, soil, water, etc., and then apply a protocol to the Earth. And we humans deal with that. We treat planet Earth the same way we treat our bodies. So they're identical. And so this don't die is not just about health and wellness. It's about a new philosophical way of our existence that values existence over all other virtues.
That was a preview of Brave New World. You can hear the whole show and listen to previous episodes by searching Brave New World Evening Standard in your podcast provider or clicking the link in the show notes.